I enjoy a nice glass of wine, but I don't pretend to be an expert in wine. I usually just want a wine that's high quality, delicious, and not too expensive. And to me, that's Bogle Family Vineyards. And here's the thing about Bogle. This is a third generation family-owned winery from California that makes exceptional wines for about 10 bucks a bottle. Bogle wines consistently earn Best Buy designations and high ratings from wine enthusiasts. And let me tell you something. The folks at Wine Enthusiast, they drink a lot of wine. They drink a lot of fancy, expensive wine. And yet they still keep giving great ratings to Bogle. And Bogle Vineyards has so many different kinds of wine. Whatever your mood, whatever you're eating, there's a wine for you. They got this great Pinot Grigio that's crisp and fruity, goes well with spicy foods, with fish. They have a classic Chardonnay that's balanced, amazing with a pork tenderloin or butter chicken. I like to take that Chardonnay and do what Jacques Pepin taught me, a couple of ice cubes in your glass of Bogle. If Jacques Pepin says it's okay, then it's okay. And there's the Bogle Pinot Noir, refined and elegant with bright fruit and about as food-friendly as a red wine can be. You're not going to believe it's only $10. Neither will your friends if you tell them. So pick up a few bottles of Bogle wherever you buy your favorite wines. Please drink responsibly.
It was a pool club in Clark, New Jersey, the Grand Centurions. I was hired to scoop ice cream and work the cash register, and within a week I was cooking.
This is Tom Colicchio, chef, restaurateur, and head judge on Top Chef. He got his first cooking job when he was 14. It was a long way from the fine dining kitchens and TV sets where he'd end up, but it did have its perks.
Damn good job. I was getting paid $275 a week under the table. You know, I was able to work a pair of cutoffs and sometimes a shirt and sometimes shoes. It was a great job. It really was.
It seems like, from what I understand, it was like from that moment, it was just like single-minded focus for decades.
Quite frankly, when I was cooking in the snack bar at the club, I didn't think of it as a career until probably soon after that, my dad suggested that I think about becoming a chef. I started working in a restaurant in town called Evelyn Seafood Restaurant, and it was a busy seafood restaurant. We would do 1,000 covers on a Saturday night. I was completely hooked after that. Yeah,
hooked on what exactly? What hooked you?
A sense of accomplishment that I got from cooking that I didn't get, say, turning in a project at school, which often was turned in incomplete. I struggled in school. And so now all of a sudden I wasn't struggling in the kitchen. It all just made sense. You know, I get a project, I'd start, I'd finish it. I was finally starting to get some affirmation for the work that I was doing, as opposed to why can't you, you know, seem to turn your homework in on time.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. A few years back, I had chef and food TV legend Jacques Pepin on the show. He told me that when he was coming up, there was no such thing as a celebrity chef. Being a chef wasn't a glamorous job. It was more like being a plumber. As we know, that has changed. In the 80s, there was an explosion of upscale restaurant culture. The chefs at a city's top spots became big names, at least for more affluent people who were into the dining scene. Then came the explosion of food media, which brought these chefs out of their fancy kitchens and into living rooms across the country. Over that time, Tom Colicchio has been at the center of it all. He never went to culinary school, but in the 80s, he worked his way up to some of the most iconic restaurants in New York. He became a central figure in the city's restaurant scene, opening his own place, Gramercy Tavern, in 1994. Then came his next restaurant, Kraft, and soon after, his restaurant group, Crafted Hospitality. When cooking competition shows became launchpads for chefs' careers, Tom was there too. In 2006, he was cast as head judge on Top Chef. As that show became a hit, Tom went from a big deal in restaurants to a TV star. Today, the world of chefs and restaurants and the world of food TV feed off each other. But I was curious to ask Tom, how exactly? What are the pros and cons of that relationship? And how does it affect both what we watch and what we eat? Tom says one of the big downsides of the rise of the celebrity chef is young chefs think they have to be on TV to be successful. You tried to set him straight a few years back when he gave the commencement address at the Culinary Institute of America.
What I said was, if you spent all this money coming to the school because you think you're going to be the next chef on TV, if your parents are sitting next to you, apologize for wasting their money. because it's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, I think the contestants that are on Top Chef that do really well, and they don't have to win, their career has changed because they're on TV. It's easier for them to access money and capital to open a restaurant. So, yeah, this being on the show, if you can capitalize on it, has paid dividends for a lot of the contestants.
So chefs can benefit from being on TV. But Tom says for young chefs in particular, the exposure comes with pitfalls.
You get on TV and all of a sudden you're asked to go on the circuit. You know, and when I say the circuit, I mean the festival circuit. Again, pre-COVID, where it was Food and Wine Aspen, and there's a festival in Austin, there's a festival in Charleston, there's a festival in New York, there's a festival in LA, there's a festival in Monterey, there's festivals everywhere.
It's like a musician going on tour.
Right. But a young chef that doesn't have that support team, and they get their first chef's job. Like maybe they do really well on Top Chef, they get a first chef's job, and all of a sudden they're getting pulled every week to go somewhere. It puts a lot of pressure on the team that they haven't developed yet, and things could slip away.
Right. It becomes hard to maintain quality in the restaurant.
Not only that, but part of being a chef is being a leader and being there for your team. And all of a sudden, you're not there. They kind of lose faith in you. So it's a balance, and That's what I always tell people. I get phone calls sometimes from restaurateurs that are back to someone on Top Chef saying, "Can you please talk to them? They're not in the restaurant. What do I do?" I'm like, not my job. Sorry, but I tell people, like, you got to stay home. You really go. I'm not saying don't do the festivals, but don't go every weekend.
Tom has felt this same pull between media and his actual cooking career. But he was a successful chef for so long before he got on TV, his restaurants were already well-oiled machines. He says he had time to train a team that can run things when he isn't there. He's better able to balance it all. But there are still downsides.
More people are coming to the restaurant because of the show, but the customer changes, and they want pictures with you. And if you're not there, they feel disappointed that you're not there to take a picture.
It just feels like if you want to have one restaurant, you're going to own it, you're going to cook the food, it's going to be your food, and you want to just run a successful business in your restaurant, you don't need TV to do that. But if you have even modest aspirations to, let's say, have a restaurant group, even to get to that point, I think it's hard to do it.
No, I completely disagree with you.
You don't think you need some amount of like celebrity?
I'll name some chefs. Mark Vetri, he's not on TV. In fact, Mark has a pretty pronounced stutter, and that's what keeps him off of TV. Paul Kahn, bunch of restaurants. You don't see him on TV. Barbara Lynch, not on TV. I can go on and on. There's plenty of chefs that go on to have multiple restaurants that never do TV. This is my point that I was making earlier to the students at CIA. You'll have success being a chef. You don't need to be on TV.
I do see Tom's point. Maybe the distinction is that if you want to be a brand with a national profile, you know, like cookbooks, cookware line, restaurants in multiple cities, you probably need TV for that. But being on TV isn't for everyone. Tom didn't think it was for him. He turned down the Top Chef job 3 times.
I have friends that are actors. My wife's a writer and director, and I know what people have to do to come across on the screen. And I certainly wasn't trained to do that.
Right.
And so that lack of training, I was definitely hesitant to put myself through that and really fail. You know, up to this point, I didn't have too many failures in terms of a business career. And so why put yourself out there?
What's the difference between the skills required to be a good chef in a restaurant and the skills required to be a good chef on TV?
In both cases, you have to have a lot of skills. But I find that the chefs who can really think on their feet quickly and conceive of a dish in their head and execute it really well are the chefs that are going to do better on TV. And I know chefs that, I mean, listen, I that's how I work. I don't plan a lot. Friends of mine, for instance, Alfred Portale, great chef, one of the best chefs this country's ever produced. He writes out the dish. He sketches it out first, spends a lot of time with it, works on it before it goes on the menu. Certain chefs do that. The heyday of Gramercy Tavern, when I had just an amazing team, I had a 10-course tasting menu that was never written. It was in my head, and when somebody ordered it, I would just tell people what to do. I had the team to do that.
You need to be an improviser on TV.
Yeah, I think it works best, yeah.
Another key to being a great chef on TV, don't look back. Tom says as soon as you start second-guessing yourself, you're going to start making mistakes. And he adds, the strain of cooking on a competition show isn't just mental.
On our show, a certain amount of physical stamina is required. It is brutal. You hear them halfway through. If they get halfway through, start to say, I'm tired. People start getting hurt. They start breaking down. Knees start to go. Backs start to go. It is physically demanding.
In the 15 years since the show debuted, how do you think it's changed?
Oh, it's changed a lot. You go back and look at the first season. It's really clunky. There's better camera work, better lighting. We used to put all our equipment in a small little cube truck.
Right.
If we had to go on location. Nowadays, it's 150 people and 3 trucks. When you see our show, there's minimum six cameras, sometimes seven or eight cameras working. You'll never see a camera in a shot. Never.
In some shows, you don't want to have one camera person moving into a place where they end up in the background of another camera person's shot.
You'll see it all the time on shows.
Right. And when you have seven or eight cameras all moving around at once, that's a very difficult thing to accomplish.
It's a ballet. And I got to say, they're just absolute professionals.
In lead-up chat with you, I reached out to several friends and colleagues who are just absolute Top Chef, you know, super fans. They've seen every episode. And our colleague at Stitcher, Abigail, she said, I think one of the biggest changes in the show is how nice the judges are. I feel like they were pretty mean in the early seasons and have gotten noticeably more like mentors and supportive. Is that something you're aware of?
Absolutely aware of it. Absolutely true. That's a great observation. The chefs have, because they've seen the show and they don't want to be that guy or that, you know, that woman on the show, they're coming at it a little differently. They're also working together much more nicely as well. It's less cutthroat and more supportive. But my role, and that's how I look at my role, is I'm a mentor. I'm going to give them feedback. I'm going to give them honest feedback. I'm not going to get into who did what, why, where, how. I don't care about that stuff. We used to, but I think, you know, we were produced early on to, you know, be a little stricter and sterner. And the whole tenor of the show has really changed. And I think it's been the last probably six seasons or so, maybe seven seasons. But it's you know, as I 15 years in and 18 seasons in, I love doing the show. I absolutely love it. I say it's like going away to summer camp because you see the, you know, it's a lot of the same
people.
A lot of the same people that you don't see during the year. A bunch of us play instruments and get together and jam, and it's great.
There's another thing that's led to changes in tone on Top Chef over the past several years. The rise of the Me Too movement in the restaurant industry. Women have spoken out about harassment and abuse and inequality in opportunities in kitchens dominated by men. In the fall of 2017, as the first wave of accusations against big-name chefs started coming out, Tom wrote a blog post that called out the larger culture of misogyny in restaurants. It was titled, An Open Letter to Male Chefs. He wrote, those of us with our own kitchens should be asking, what have I been able to take for granted on my way to the top that women often can't? And how can I help fix that? A month later, the first stories came out about Mario Batali and Ken Friedman, detailing accusations of sexual harassment and assault against the two restaurateurs. Tom says, without a doubt, this is also part of the reason the Top Chef has evolved.
There's a lot less sexism, you know, the banter back and forth that, the first season, you know, someone saying, I'm not your bitch, that would never happen. I mean, and that became the tagline for the season. It was on a shirt. That doesn't happen. I think everybody's much more respectful, and I think they're, you know, a lot of it was in jest and a lot of it was in fun and joking, but I think people are realizing that you know, one person's joke is one person's slander. And so the industry's changing. I think that behavior is just unacceptable. You know, you look at the chefs, they're all much more supportive. And this is why I feel really good about where our industry's heading, because I'm looking at the chefs that are coming on the show and I look how supportive they are versus where they were 15 years ago where they were cutthroat. And I think that's where our industry's heading.
That's all obviously good news, mm-hmm. that things are moving in a better direction. Still, there are on the show and in the world of restaurant kitchens still some bad actors, mm-hmm. and still some people who engage in some bullying behavior. I understand that some of that is good drama for a TV show. I'm curious, like, how much of that do you see?
Zero. Absolutely none of it. I mean, I see the chefs. Number one, we are not allowed to interact with the chefs at all unless we're on camera. And when we're on camera, meaning where they're cooking for us, if I'm doing a walk through the kitchen.
When they're on their best behavior, if you're walking through the kitchen.
Or not, when I'm walking through the kitchen.
Presumably.
When they're cooking, you know, when they're presenting food, when we're eating food, when we're critiquing them and at judge's table. That's it. Outside of that, we do not talk to them. We don't see them. Anything that's going on in where they're living, we don't see it. Sometimes we hear rumor about it. Sometimes, you know, but for the most part, we don't see it and don't care, and therefore don't judge on it.
And so that's interesting because, on one hand, I can understand why those rules would be in place, and it makes for one line of argument, I'm sure this is why these rules exist, is because it makes for a more fair competition. Mm-hmm. You're judging based on the food. You're not going to get distracted by any other sort of like reality TV tension. On the other hand, I feel like sometimes the bad actors or bullies do well on the show, even in recent years. I feel like sort of part of the reason why bad behavior has been tolerated for so long in restaurant kitchens is that there's this idea that as long as the food is incredible, whatever you had to do behind the scenes to get that result is justified. So I wonder if perhaps that there's that same mentality in the show, and if perhaps it might make sense, like, should bad behavior in the kitchen be part of the judging?
No, I don't think it should be.
As one example to Tom, I bring up Michael Voltaggio, who won Top Chef Vegas in 2009. During a challenge, Voltaggio was teamed up with another contestant, Robin Leventhal. She was in charge of dessert, and at one point he grabbed her sauce bottle from her hand and started finishing her dish for her, the way he thought it should be done.
Can I do it? This is my dessert. This is my damn dessert.
Yeah, then can you cut him smaller? And don't cuss at me again like that.
I don't want you
to cuss at me like that again. Do you understand
me? I asked you to
don't talk to me like that again.
I asked you to let
don't
me
talk.
Do
I'm helping you. I'm helping you. This is a restaurant, okay? Be professional. Go
play. Come on. I asked Tom, should something like that be a factor in the judging on Top Chef?
I don't think that's where we should be focusing, you know, cornering someone in a walk-in and threatening them if they didn't have sex. Like, that's horrible. Purposely overlooking someone for promotion because they're a woman or a minority, that's a problem. Again, the off-color jokes, the racist jokes, the homophobic jokes that were commonplace in kitchens, understanding how the person on the other side of that hears it. That's not to be tolerated anymore. Taking a spoon out of someone's hand because you don't trust they're saucing it, to me, that's not bad behavior. That's just wanting to win and, you know, but just saying, hey, give me that. I don't know. I don't want to make excuses for anybody, but also if we're not there to see it, how do I judge on that? You know, I it's a competition. We decided season one, we're going to judge on food, and that's it. There's a lot of stuff that we talk about what makes a great chef and leadership and all that. That's all great to talk about. We judge on the food in front of us, and that's it.
I'm torn. I don't pretend to have the right answer, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in the way that you've done it. It's just like, to me, it's an interesting question to ask. You know, like I've heard you talk about the idea that, you know, a chef is more than just
sure.
a cook. A chef is really
sure.
like a manager, an overseer,
yeah.
that a leader. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to pick the top chef, the way that a person treats other people in the kitchen, you know, might be something that I don't know. I understand that what you're saying, like the logistics of it would be difficult.
Yeah.
You're not going to sit there for 24/7 watching every single chef. But I do think it's an interesting thing to consider.
Yeah. When you think about leadership, you're talking about hiring, you know, hiring the right team, managing the right team. That's not going to come out in a reality show. You know, they're not hiring staff. They're not putting policies in place. They're not, it's a little different. There's a lot to being a successful chef. And again, let's start with the word chef. It doesn't mean best cook. It means boss. That's a French word for boss. If Bruce Springsteen were French, he would be called the chef, not the boss. And so yeah, there's the criteria that go into being a successful chef, and you can't judge that in a reality show.
Top Chef's approach is clearly working. It's now in its 18th season, and over that time, the show's universe has grown dramatically with spin-off shows, cookbooks, even a TV dinner at one point. But in the past year, the restaurant industry has been much less fortunate. When we come back, Tom and I talk about surviving the past year as a restaurant owner and what the future of restaurants will look like. Stick around.
Time to cook up some advertisements.
Norwegian Cruise Line breaks the boundaries of global cruise travel. When you cruise with NCL, you're going to get award-winning specialty restaurants, a variety of food and beverage offerings, immersive entertainment, and the most thrilling experiences at sea. It is first class. These ships have all kinds of specialty restaurants, Brazilian steakhouse, French, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Mexican. Select ships also feature alfresco dining on the waterfront and Ocean Boulevard, an oceanside promenade lined with bars and restaurants. Norwegian provides guests with truly authentic and fresh dining and bar experiences complemented by exceptional service. Almost everything you'll eat is prepared from scratch by highly experienced chefs. And they got whatever you're going to be in the mood for. You want a quick, casual family meal? They've got that. You want a beautiful four-course feast? They've got that too. and you can sip something delicious at one of up to 23 unique bar and lounge options per ship. Visit and explore exciting destinations around the world and enjoy unique experiences on board. With no set dining and entertainment times and no formal dress codes, you have the flexibility to design your ideal vacation. Book your next adventure at ncl.com. Whether you're a family vacation traveler, a business tripper, or a long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. They've got over 7,000 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels, and you will get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. I especially love those Cambria Hotels. They have locally inspired hotel bars with all kinds of specialty cocktails, downtown locations right in the center of all the action. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces. That way, if you're a business traveler, you'll be able to get all your work done. On-site restaurants, fantastic. And then at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles and great pools for the whole family and spacious rooms. I mean, if you have kids, you understand the importance of the pool. If you stay at a hotel with a pool, almost nothing else matters. Fortunately, all the Choice Hotels take care of all the other stuff too, but I mean, a pool is a great start. Whatever kind of vacation you're going on, whatever kind of travel you're doing, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. I continue to get a lot of flack for my PB&J technique, okay? Jelly on the top, jelly on the bottom, peanut butter in the middle. That's the way to go. And the first thing people say is, well, when you spread the jelly on both sides and then spread the peanut butter on top, you're going to tear the bread. And my answer to you is, use better bread. Like Hero Bread. You get that whole wheat Hero Bread. It's got some grain. It's got some heft. It's got some flavor. It's got some texture. And it will stand up to my excellent PB&J technique. Hero makes delicious breads that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, but plenty of protein and fiber. The soft, fluffy experience you love when enjoying a refreshing BLT, a savory breakfast burrito, or a mouthwatering cheeseburger, you can have all that with Hero Breads. And let me tell you, we are a big burrito-eating family in our house. Breakfast burritos happen multiple times a week, and these Hero Flour tortillas are perfect for it. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co, that's hero.co, and use code Sporkful at checkout for that discount. That's code Sporkful at hero.co. I just got a very wonderful shipment of goodies from the folks at Reese's. And let me tell you something. These people remain the absolute worldwide leaders in bringing together chocolate and peanut butter. Of course, we know the peanut butter cups remain transcendent. But have you tried the Reese's Sticks? They're wafers with peanut butter in between each wafer, all coated in chocolate. I mean, the combination of sweet chocolate and salty peanut butter just brings people joy, and the folks at Reese's do it better than anyone. So shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you, found wherever candy is sold. Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. In last week's show, I talked with Ayesha Curry, who at 32 has built a food empire. But despite her best-selling cookbooks, TV shows, and cookware line, she says people still underestimate her.
The struggle for me is in people realizing how hard I really do work. Everybody thinks things just happen, and they don't. And there's like a lot of behind the scenes. I'm a very behind the scenes worker. So I like to work silently and then like have the work speak for itself. And oftentimes what ends up happening is people just think that it pops out of nowhere, and it doesn't.
We also talk about the pros and cons of cooking with your kids. That episode with Ayesha Curry is up now. Get it wherever you got this one. Okay, back to Tom Colicchio. In addition to his work as a chef, restaurateur, and TV star, Tom has spent years as a food activist. He's advocated for free school lunches and ending hunger in the U.S. Last year, as COVID decimated the restaurant industry, Tom took on a new cause. He co-founded the Independent Restaurant Coalition, which lobbied for relief for the restaurants hit hardest. Thanks to his history in the restaurant business and as an advocate, Tom's just as comfortable talking about food supply chains as he is critiquing a dish on Top Chef. And that knowledge has come in handy as COVID has exposed flaws in our food systems.
One of the biggest problems that we saw in food processing plants, meat processing plants, where so many people were affected because of the way they work, it's all close quarters, they couldn't shut down. And what we're seeing is that our supply is too centralized. It's very efficient, and that's why it's been done for efficiency, but it needs to be more spread out. One pork plant went down, I think, in South Dakota, took 5% of the pork. in the country. It's efficient. It's not resilient.
COVID didn't create these problems. It just exposed them. And Tom says having so much of our food supply centralized in a handful of locations, it's going to become a bigger problem as climate change progresses.
We're going to start seeing more and more drought storms that are going to really test the limits of our food production in this country. It happened last year. A lot of the corn crop in Iowa was destroyed from the derecho, I think it was called, this localized storm. So we need to spread out production a bit more to make, again, our food production more resilient.
So when COVID hit, Tom started advocating for the restaurant industry. But he also had to figure out what to do in his own restaurants. In March of last year, when restaurants were closing down, he had to lay off about 300 of his employees. What was that like for you?
One of the worst days of my professional career. We were in pretty good contact. I had a pretty good handle on what I thought was going to happen. I'm a bit of a news junkie, and I was looking at news reports coming out of Asia back in January about this. Started telling my staff in February to get ready to close down. Tell them to stop buying wine, stop, you know. And then we started talking to the staff, saying, this is a possibility. From talking to people, I had a pretty good sense that unemployment was going to be pretty robust. So telling my staff, listen, apply right away. It's going to be robust. It's going to get you through. But still, it's just a terrible day.
Thanks in part to lobbying by the Independent Restaurant Coalition, the latest stimulus package included $28 billion specifically for independent restaurants. Now, as we turn a corner with COVID, the industry is facing a different issue. Now, as restaurants are opening back up, there's a lot of talk about a labor shortage in the industry. There are some who say, well, the increased unemployment is paying people, quote unquote, too much. Therefore, they're not incentivized to go back to work in restaurants. Others say, well, there's problems with the working conditions in a lot of restaurants, or the COVID safety or other issues. What are your thoughts? What is the cause of this labor shortage?
I think it's twofold. One, people are afraid to go back to work. They don't want to get sick. I think as more and more people are vaccinated, they'll feel a little better about going back to work. I think that in restaurants, think about the front of the house. You know, I think they're concerned that they're going to come in, they're going to give up unemployment, and they're going to get one or two shifts, and that's not going to cut it, and they're going to lose their benefits, or maybe they're promised four shifts, but eventually they're going to get cut down to one or two. So I understand that. There's a lot of people who left our industry. There's a lot of young people who moved out of the cities and moved back home with their parents. There's also a lot of people who started jobs. I mean, I read a story recently of a pastry cook, I think, or an assistant chef who was working at Gramercy Tavern who started doing her baked goods from home. And she has a business right now, and it's not going to go back to work because she started a business. And so a lot of people started businesses during COVID. Everyone had a side hustle, a food side hustle. And a lot of them are going, okay, I just made a business. Why? I'm not going to go back to work in a restaurant. So there's a lot of reasons why we're seeing a labor shortage. Not at all attributed to robust unemployment benefits.
Putting aside pay and the unemployment issue, just in terms of working conditions, are there things that restaurants can and should do, whether COVID-related or just larger restaurant issues, that would make these jobs more attractive?
Listen, I think it comes down to just being fair. You know, there's a certain amount of breaks that people are supposed to get. Make sure they're taking their breaks. Make sure little things like when you sit down for family meal.
The staff meal.
If you're talking about the evening, which most people do, people have to be punched in. I mean, little things like making sure the staff meal's better. It's hard work because you're on your feet and you're dealing with customers. You're in a hot kitchen. That's not going to change. But it's how you motivate people. You know, the days of getting in someone's face to motivate them, it's over. Or you have a labor force that won't accept that. You can blame it on all kinds of things. I've heard the brigade system, the hierarchy of the kitchen being blamed for it. No, it's not. I don't think that's the problem. I think it's an inability for someone at the top to communicate their vision, to be clear about it, to hold people accountable without belittling them, and to... You know, just creating an environment that is feels better to work in. That's it. Now, I think a lot of, you know, I've tried to do this in my restaurants. Have I been perfect? Probably not. But this is how I try to run my business. And I've got a lot of, you know, people who have been very loyal over the years.
Tom says another thing that would help address the labor shortage, make sure cooks are paid better.
The big change that we have got to come to terms with is the idea that kitchen labor, it's cheap labor because they're not skilled. You hear that a lot. Unskilled labor. Nonsense. It's skilled labor. Often when you see someone who's unskilled is the recent graduate from culinary school that has a lot of book knowledge about food, but doesn't have the experience. But then there's a whole other level of really skilled cooks who have no aspirations to be, you know, a great chef or be on TV, but they can cook with the best of them. They deserve a much higher pay scale than someone coming out of culinary school who really has no experience. But what the person coming out of culinary school has is student debt. And so they want to move up the ladder very quickly. It used to be, you know, when I was coming up, you worked 10 years as a cook before you took a sous chef's position, and then 5 years before you took a chef's position. Now it's like a year and a half out of culinary school, so I want to be a sous chef. Well, you do because you got bills to pay.
And we should say, I mean, the cooks, the non-culinary institute cooks you're referring to are more likely to be immigrants, newer immigrants. And so that's, I think there's also sort of a prejudice there in the perception that they're somehow unskilled.
Yes, I think for the general public. But you know what? They understand their skill level. And you get a someone who's been working in kitchens for 10 years and can hold down a pasta station in the busiest of Italian restaurants, they know their value.
In the earlier days of COVID, the chef and restaurant owner Gabrielle Hamilton wrote a fantastic piece in the New York Times, which you may have seen. I'm sure you know her, for folks who don't, I mean, she's had a restaurant called Prune in New York for 20 years, well-known and well-respected, certainly in the New York area. She wrote this piece about the decision to close her restaurant in the early days of COVID. And she talked about the increasing financial pressure on restaurants. Mm-hmm. Then COVID hits and she writes, "Restaurant operators had already become oddly cagey and quick to display a false front with each other. You asked, 'How's business?' And the answer always was, 'Yeah, great, best quarter we ever had.' But then coronavirus hits and these same restaurant owners rush into the public square yelling, 'Fire, fire!' They now reveal that they had also been operating under razor-thin margins. It instantly turns 180 degrees. Even famous, successful chefs, owners of empires, those with supremely wealthy investors, upon whom you imagine they could call for capital should they need it, now openly describe how dire a position they're in. The sad testimony gushes out, confirming everything that used to be so convincingly denied." What are your thoughts on that?
I think she's a very talented writer.
Have you had that similar experience?
Of being an accomplished writer? No.
Well, I mean, like, have you found yourself being one of the people she describes?
No. I mean, I think I've been, you know, I don't think I've been putting up some false front that everything is peaches and cream. I've been always pretty clear that's a tough business and margins are thin. In terms of yelling fire in the public square, yeah, I was out there yelling fire in the public square. I got a sense that there was an opportunity for targeted relief for our industry. So yeah, I'll scream in the public square to help out restaurants. I think history will judge me for doing the right thing by going to the public square and letting politicians, letting the public know about razor-thin margins and about what would happen to the 15 million people who worked in our industry. And once you factor in fishermen and farmers and winemakers and cheesemakers and plumbers and electricians and exterminators who also support our industry, we're talking about 20 million people who probably make a living from independent restaurants. And so, I made it my mission along with a bunch of other fantastic chefs and restaurateurs across the country to get that targeted help. So if I resemble that remark, fine, so be it.
What has COVID revealed to you about restaurants that you didn't know before?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Our industry was going through big changes before COVID. COVID just, you know, shone a spotlight on our industry. I think unless variants of this pandemic come back, you know, in a bad way, I suspect that come December, we're going to see our businesses explode. There's a lot of money, a lot of pent-up demand sitting on the sideline. People want to get out. Back in 2008, during the recession, it took me 5 years to get back to pre-recession business. I think this cycle is going to be a lot faster. I've been doing this for 35 years. I expected chefs and restaurateurs to be resilient. You know, the people who are out there feeding frontline workers, feeding members of the community, feeding kids at school, That's the restaurant industry that I know. That's the restaurant industry that deserves to be saved. And yeah, there are bad actors and there's systemic problems in our industry. But if you look at the generosity, that's the memory that I'll hold dear to my heart.
So over the past year, Tom's been busy with the Independent Restaurant Coalition, with filming a season of Top Chef. But like a lot of us, he's been at home a lot too, cooking three meals a day for his family. And completely by accident, that home cooking turned into his latest project.
Well, yeah, I opened a new restaurant last week called Velada. We took our private dining room next door to Kraft that we actually had just renovated before COVID. And so we just opened a new restaurant there called Velada. And we sort of did it as a pop-up, but there's a very good chance we're going to make it permanent. And it's an Italian trattoria. I've never really cooked Italian food in a restaurant. I found myself doing more of that style of cooking at home and thought, this is probably what I should be doing right now. And what's great is you know, we're only open four nights a week. I'm cooking. I'm actually working the pasta station every night so far. It's been great.
So who yells at you when you're falling behind?
No one, man. It's, I yell at myself. I'm tough on myself.
How long had it been since you were cooking on a line on a regular basis?
Oh, on a regular basis, it's been a while. But before COVID, I was doing it a lot, you know, where I'd go into Kraft and go to the meat station, tell the cook, you know, step aside. I'll work station for an hour or so. But, you know, as soon as I got tired, I would tap out. But I love doing it. I'm, you know, a line cook at heart. That's what I love doing. It's where I'm most comfortable, especially if you can just pretend you're not the restaurant owner. Put your head down, get into a groove, and put out great food. And that's what I love doing.
Just like back at the swim club.
Exactly, exactly. It's only I'm not in cutoffs and flip-flops, although I wish I were.
That's chef and restaurateur Tom Colicchio. Season 18 of Top Chef is airing now, and you can find a full list of his restaurants at craftedhospitality.com. Next week on the show, I talk with Gustavo Alvarez, who wrote a book about cooking while in prison. He'll talk about learning to boil water with an electric cord and a razor blade, and he'll share the story of the instant ramen that saved his life. That's next week. While you wait for that one, make sure you check out last week's show with culinary empire builder Aisha Curry. And please make sure you connect with our show so you don't miss future episodes. In Spotify and Stitcher, hit follow. In Apple Podcasts, subscribe. You can do it right now while you're listening. Thanks. This show is produced by me, along with senior producer
Emma Morgenstern
and producer
Andre Sohero.
Our editor is
Tracy Samuelson.
The show is mixed by
Jared O'Connell.
Music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher. Our executive producers are Peter Clowney and Daisy Rosario. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Lillian in Boston, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.